I'm Thorn Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. And welcome to Elliot Neistat, the interview. Rag Radio, for those of you who don't know, comes your way every Friday afternoon, 2 to 3 p.m. On Co-op, which is an all-volunteer, cooperatively run community radio station in Austin, Texas. We are rebroadcast by several other community radio stations around the country. And the show is put up as a podcast at the Internet Archive. If you want to go and listen to any of the shows, go to our Rag Radio page. You can listen to anything we've ever done, including this show, once we get the podcast up, which is after a couple of days. Go to theragblog.com/ragradio. Theragblog.com/ragradio, and you can listen to any show we've ever done. Tracy Schultz is my engineer. Tracy, what's with this weather?
Oh, it's nice and warm, right? For January?
It's at least like a spring day.
Yeah. It's a little early spring for us.
And whenever it's really beautiful here, for the people listening in other places, we'd like to rub it in. Roger Baker is our photographer and frequently our guest or co-questioner. So that's our crew today. The Austin Chronicle wrote earlier this month, a tectonic shift just rumbled through Austin politics. Democrat Representative Elliot Neistat, the dean of the Travis County House delegation, has announced he will not run for re-election. The Chronicle added that, along with Congressman Lloyd Doggett, Neistat has been the defining face of Austin progressive politics for over two decades. A native New Yorker, Representative Neistat, who has lived in Texas for 45 years and has represented District 49 since 1990, came to the state as a VISTA volunteer in Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty. And we're going to talk about how he came here. It's a great story. Elliot was a founding board member of the House Progressive Caucus in 13 legislative sessions. He's passed 330 bills. His legislation has focused on the needs of low and moderate income people, children, senior citizens, minorities, people with disabilities, victims of domestic violence, and vulnerable populations. And he has been a tireless advocate, unfortunately, without success, for medical marijuana. Okay, Elliot, first, I would like to sort of, as a point of personal privilege, first express my great disappointment that you are not going to be in the legislature anymore, but also my gratitude, and I speak for many people, for the incredible work you've done as a champion for progressive causes. So I'm bowing.
You're very welcome.
Okay. First, and I don't know if people are starting to call you Hamlet, but you went through it for, a month or so, trying to decide if you were going to, you decided you were going to resign, then you weren't, then you were. Tell us what those considerations were and what you're looking at now.
Well, my family and close friends and others were concerned about my long-term health and well-being. I've had some bicycle accidents and heart surgeries, and you get stressed out and anxious a lot when you serve in the Texas House of Representatives trying to do what I've tried to do. And I found myself thinking about maybe it is time. They all suggested that it's time. They said you've served for nearly 26 years. That's a long time. They teased me about getting old and fat.
You're far from fat, and you certainly don't look old.
They were very concerned about anxiety, stress, and not being happy a lot, constantly having to battle, constantly. And I had thought about not seeking re-election the session before for similar reasons. But then Wendy Davis and my good friend Leticia Vandepute called me and said, "We're running. It's a long shot, but if the stars align, it's possible that I, Wendy, will be the next governor and Leticia We got elected the same time, Leticia, will be the lieutenant governor. And if that comes to pass, we need you in the House of Representatives to be our go-to person on health, human services, and other issues that affect vulnerable populations. We need you there. And I said, wouldn't I feel like an idiot if I announced I'm not seeking re-election, and they ran and they won, and I wasn't there. So that was easy. This time it was much harder, very difficult, the most difficult decision certainly of my adult life. And I still second-guess myself. Some people said, why don't you run for one more term? But I thought about it, and also while I was going through this decision-making process, I had calls from several people who indicated an interest in running should I decide to not seek re-election. None of them wanted to run against me. They all hoped I would run again. And I got to know these people, and they're exceptional. It's almost like a, quote, new generation of young leaders ready to step up. And I thought about their passion and their energy. And I said, if I do decide to step down so I can do some writing, so I can do some reading, so I can spend some time at Barton Springs, I know District 49 will be in good hands.
Right.
That made it easier for me. But I still second-guess myself, and I look forward to being involved, but in a different way.
Yeah, are you jonesing, though? I mean, are you worried that you're going to get up and feel like you don't know what you're... What are you going to do? What do you have in mind? What are you going to do next?
Well, first I'm going to start spending time at Barton Springs again,
right,
and I'm going to clean out my garage. I have been thinking and talking about writing a book,
right,
based on my experiences as the New Yorker who reluctantly, not by choice, ended up in Texas and somehow was able to, years later, lie and cheat and get elected to a seat in the Texas House of Representatives. And I've had some amazing experiences serving initially with one of my heroes and mentors, Ann Richards, and then through the George Bush years, and I have great stories about that, followed by the Rick Perry era, and now, of course, the Greg Abbott days. And a lot of the experiences I've had that I would like to write about in one way or another relate to me having grown up, born and bred in New York City, and ended up here.
Okay, and we will talk about those experiences after a while, but right now, okay, you were given you were awarded the you were presented on December 3rd during the AmeriCorps Vista 50th anniversary event. You were awarded or recognized with the President's Lifetime Achievement Award, Corporation for National and Community Service. Am I right? Am I getting two things conflated?
That's true.
Okay, so Vista. I mean, I grew up around Vista people. I grew up in the 60s. We published Space City, originally Space City News, an underground newspaper in Houston, and actually the original six-person collective, two of them were actually on the Vista payroll, so we were actually a Vista project, the Crazy Radicals. So, I mean, I think Vista's was remarkable. It was just a revolutionary thing that Johnson did. He did a number of them. So you were in New York. You grew up where?
In 3 years in Brooklyn, and then
Brooklyn.
My family, my parents moved us to Sunnyside, Queens.
Sunnyside, Queens.
But I went to high school in Manhattan at Stuyvesant High School, and then Queens College, part of the City University of New York.
So you understand New York values.
I do. I believe in them. I uphold them.
Yeah, Donald Trump is going to try to deny them, but no, he's not. Actually, he's dead. So how did that transition happen? How did you get involved with Vista, and then tell us about the trip?
Okay, I don't have time to tell the whole story, but it's important to know that I did not come to Texas by choice. I never really wanted to come.
You thought you were going to San Francisco, didn't you?
Yeah. what I knew about Texas was Charles Whitman and the UT Tower, John F. Kennedy, and baseball and football. But when I finished college in the late 60s, I did sign up to be a Vista volunteer. Today you hear more about AmeriCorps. because Bill Clinton wanted to have his own version of the Domestic Peace Corps. But Lyndon Johnson, as part of the War on Poverty, created Volunteers in Service to America. So I signed up to be a VISTA volunteer. And the people in Washington said, we would love to have you serve as a frontline warrior in Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty. They said, because you're from a big city, New York, we will send you to a VISTA project in a big city. And they promised me an assignment in San Francisco. And I said, yes. But you know the government. They lied, and they sent me to Eagle Pass, Texas. Eagle Pass in Maverick County, across the Rio Grande from Piedras Negras, Mexico, which loosely translated means Black Rock. I had to tell family and friends back home that in response to their question, how San Francisco? Well, I'm not exactly in San Francisco. I'm in Eagle Pass, Texas. And they would say, no, seriously, how's San Francisco? But that whole experience, I've done a lot of writing about it, fictional. We went through VISTA training in San Antonio for 6 weeks. And the purpose of the War on Poverty was to, quote, eliminate the paradox of poverty in the midst of plenty in this nation, eliminate poverty. So how do you train young, idealistic kids from the East Coast and West Coast and Chicago to eliminate poverty? Nobody knew, so they trained us to be community organizers, a la Barack Obama, Cesar Chavez, and they emphasized this concept of maximum feasible participation of the poor. Get the program, the intended program beneficiaries involved in planning and running and doing what they think is in their best interest. Don't impose your white middle class values. And on the last day of training, the director pointed to six of us. We were all from the East Coast. We had each been promised VISTA placements in either San Francisco or Portland, Oregon. On the last day, the director pointed to us and said, oh, by the way, you six who thought you were going to the West Coast, there's been a big change in the plans. Tomorrow morning, you'll be on a Trailways bus from San Antonio, where training was, to Eagle Pass, Texas. We thought it was a joke, but it wasn't. So the next morning, we were on that bus. It felt like it took about 3 days to get from San Antonio down to the border. It took 6 or 7 hours, and the bus just went for hours and hours, and it went down the interstate and then hooked right southwest on Highway 57, went for hours and hours, and none of us had ever seen that kind of South Texas scenery, you know.
So did you have the terrors?
Pretty much. Yeah. Cactus, tumbleweed, javelinas, armadillos. And we were in shock driving down. We didn't see any people. The bus was filled, and the bus went for hours. And finally, on the outskirts of something, the bus stopped, and everybody got off except the new recruits, the VISTA volunteers. So I went
going to
the bus driver, and I said, excuse me, sir, we're supposed to be let out at the downtown Eagle Pass bus station. And he looked me in the eye and said, you putting me on, boy? We were there. That was the downtown Eagle Pass station. And there we were with a mandate to eliminate poverty. The next day, the director of the Community Action Agency, very dynamic woman. Oh, the Community Action Agency was called the Winter Garden Tri-County Community Action Agency, serving Dimmitt, Zavala, and Maverick counties. She took us on a tour of Eagle Pass. Didn't take very long, but we ended up in a low-income neighborhood, a barrio, now they're known as colonias, called Seco Mines, Seco, dry, no water, no sewers. And there are about 35 or 40 houses, and these were really poor people. But the houses were clean and in okay shape, considering. But either behind or next to every one of those houses was an outhouse, a functioning outhouse. And I remember thinking, okay, you didn't join the Peace Corps. You're not in Togo in West Africa or El Salvador. You're in the United States of America. And I thought, well, there are no outhouses in New York City, except maybe a few in Brooklyn. But it came as a major shock. And
Those outhouses in Brooklyn have since been turned into artist studios.
I know. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we tried to do what the people wanted us to do. In Secco Mines, we handed out a needs assessment because we'd been trained. And we said, you have to fill out this needs assessment. It's about 10 pages, and then we'll talk about what we can help you with. And an old man, about 85, he said, we don't need to do a needs assessment. You do. We got trained to be organizers. You have to do the needs assessment. He said, we don't need a needs assessment. If you can help us with the agua, we want you here. We'll work with you. If you can't, go back to New York City. And so that was one of the projects.
So the needs very quickly got assessed.
Yeah, another group in a different neighborhood, they wanted a Head Start program.
Right.
So we worked with them, got them involved, maximum feasible participation of the poor, and several other projects. I did a lot of work with the Community Action Agency applying for grants, but we started a teen club. It was very exciting. And
so it ended up being a rewarding experience, what you were
absolutely,
kind of...
Without question. Yeah. I do have one cute story. We started the Head Start program, and we had about 75 kids. Some Vistas had rented a house on El Indio Road in Eagle Pass, and all the kids were in the backyard. We had parents, community volunteers, Vistas supervising, running the program, and a car showed up that none of us had ever seen. I think it had government markings on the side, and an Hispanic man, all dressed up in a coat and tie. It was the middle of the summer. I know I was wearing my uniform, sandals, cutoffs, T-shirt. My hair was a little bit longer. It was hot. And this man walked up to the gate and started looking at all the kids and looking at us. And then he opened the gate and he walked over to me and just started laughing out loud in my face. Felt like it went on for a few minutes. It was probably 30 or 40 seconds. And I said, sir, is there a problem? Can we help you? And he stopped. He said, no, there's no problem. And then he started laughing again. And then he caught his breath and he said, don't get mad. He said, there's no problem. He said, I just went to work for Vista. And I'm now the program officer for all the Vista projects in South Texas and West Texas. And he said, I had to come down here first to meet the guy from New York City who thought he was going to San Francisco. And he put out his hand and said, my name is Gonzalo Barrientos. And former Senator Gonzalo Barrientos became one of my mentors and closest friends, and his family more or less adopted me. And over the years, I worked with him when he ran for office. I served as his staff counsel. So that was an interesting friendship that began at that time.
Okay. We're talking with Elliot Neistat, and we're talking about the journey right now. And we will be back in just a minute. I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is RAG Radio.
And my time was running wild, a million dead-end streets, and every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me, but I've never caught a glimpse of how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
Don't wanna be a richer man.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
It's gonna have to be a different man. Size, but never leave the stream of
warm and permanent sand. So the days float through my eyes, but still the days seem the same. And these children that you spit on as they try to change their worlds are immune to your consultations. They're quite aware of what they're going through.
Changes. Turn and face the strange.
Changes. Don't tell them to grow up on out of it.
Changes. Turn and face the strange.
Changes. Where's your shame? You've left us up to her next to me. Time may change me, but you can't twist time. Strange.
This is Rag Radio. I'm Thorne Dreyer, and my guest is Texas progressive icon Elliot Neistat. He smiled at that. who is leaving the Texas legislature after 26 years, or it's going on 26. It will be 26 when you leave. So, and he will be greatly missed. I should mention, by the way, while we have, and we're going to go back to his story about how he got here, which is such a wonderful story. We've heard it, but we. It never stops being wonderful. We always get lots of email and lots of Facebook comments and stuff. So I wanted to read just a couple of them. Steve Spear said about Elliot. He said, "A politician never touched by scandal in any way. A real giant in the House. No one has fought the Republicans and a handful of sellout Democrats harder than Elliot. He will be missed in many ways because his example gave courage to many others in countless tough fights." And he mentions his staff with Judy Dale, Dorothy Brown, Nancy Walker, and others was simply the, in all caps, best. And then Carry On, the wonderful Carry On, our old friend, the artist and stand-up comic and everything that Carry has said, "Elliot is a good guy. We need more like him." So that's Elliot Neistat, who's my guest on Rag Radio. All right. back to your story about you were just meeting Gonzalo Barrientos, and then you said that he became your mentor. And then how did you get to Austin?
Well, after we eliminated poverty in Eagle Pass, Texas, you may remember the front page story in the New York Times.
Poverty gone.
Poverty gone. I worked with Vista for a few more years, ended up in Austin, went to graduate school, studying community organizing, helped Gonzalo run for the House. The first time he lost, the second time he won. I taught for a while at the School of Social Work. I went to law school when I came out. Gonzalo was in the Senate, and he called me and said, "Elliot, I'm over in the Senate now, and you've got all these degrees, and I trust you and respect you, and need you to come be my staff counsel. I can pay you what we paid you when you were a Vista volunteer, but I can get you a parking place near the Capitol." I did that for two sessions working with the senator. It was very exciting. It was very challenging. I quickly learned that you can address the same issues that we tried to address during the heyday of the war on poverty at the grassroots level. You can address those issues on a different battlefield, so to speak, in the Texas legislature. And one day we were sitting around Schultz's beer garden, 1989, and several people said, "Elliot, you ought to run. You've been president of all these neighborhood associations. You're University of Texas grad twice over. People respect you. You know the legislature. You ought to run." I said, "Against who?" They said, "The three-term Republican incumbent from North and Northwest Austin."
Of course.
I said, "He's knocked off every Democrat. I'm from New York City. He would call me a carpetbagger and an outside agitator. I'm an ex-Vista volunteer. He would accuse me of being a communist." Barrientos said, "You might have a shot, but two things." He said, "Never talk about a state income tax. It's the kiss of death." He said, "More importantly, never mention that you're from New York City." So I decided to run, and all these consultants wanted me to pay them lots of money to organize a campaign, and I didn't have any money. The incumbent had probably a couple of $100,000. And I thought, well, what would they do that I can't do as a community organizer? So I ran my own campaign and had over 100 volunteers and went door to door, door to door. And it was summer and it was hot. And I met with people. And we had a $4 billion shortfall. Texas, as most of your listeners know, is at the bottom of the ladder in almost every important category of health and human services.
Still is.
Yeah, 52nd, I would tell people. And yeah, we rank 52nd on per capita spending on alcohol and substance abuse. And they would, how can we be 52nd? And I would say, because we're behind Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. I mentioned the income tax, but I didn't push it. I never mentioned that I'm from New York City. And what do you think the incumbent, we'll call him Bob, because that's his name, what do you think he was doing the whole time? Nothing, nothing. He'd knocked off every Democrat. So we think his consultant sat him down probably early October and said, Bob, you have nothing to worry about. This guy's from New York. He's an ex-Vista volunteer communist. He's a carpetbagger. And he's also Jewish. So they said, let's go up on TV. Let's just make sure, because this guy, Elliot Neistat, is picking up a lot of endorsements and generating interest and has all these people walking door to door, which no one had ever done up in that part of Austin. So they did something brilliant. They went up on TV with a commercial that some people still talk about. And it's a takeoff on the original Pace Picante sauce commercial, where a group of cowboys is sitting around the campfire eating supper, and they run out of the Pace hot sauce. So the cook brings them some other kind. One of the cowboys picks up the jar and opens it and smells it and looks at it and says, this ain't Pace Picante sauce. This stuff was made in New York City. Get a rope. Bob's commercial, that was the real commercial. Bob's commercial started out with the skyline of New York City. And the voice said, New York City, do you want a liberal social worker from New York City? And then the Pace jar appeared on the screen with my photo superimposed over the logo, and they got a look-alike cowboy from the original Pace Picante sauce ad. And he said, New York City, I bet he's even for a state income tax. Income tax, get a rope. I won by a little over 10 percentage points. I took the oath of office the same week that Ann Richards did when she was sworn in as governor. So I've served through the Ann Richards era, George Bush era, Rick Perry era, and now the beginning of the Greg Abbott era. And it's been a roller coaster, and I've loved every second of it.
Do you know if, by the way, just to step back for a second, do you know if that commercial is actually exists any, if it exists anywhere in video on
the
YouTube?
The original Pace Picante sauce commercial you can find. I've seen it. I don't know if Bob's...
No, I meant the one, the
original,
the adaption,
one. Yes,
the
adaptation. I saw it recently.
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool. Well, so people can search that down. Okay, it's... First, you know, you're talking about the Ann Richards era. That was when there were actually Democrats who actually had some power or some influence. It's always been a crazy place, the Texas legislature. But tell us a little bit about how it's changed into what it is now.
You have to understand.
And compare the two,
sure,
times.
You have to understand that when the Democrats were in power, and that was during the Ann Richards era, and in turn the Pete Laney as Speaker era, it was the conservative Democrats who over time became Republicans who were really in power. So those members of the House and Senate who focused on issues like I've focused on, trying to help vulnerable populations, save the planet, health, human services, education, housing, it's always been hard for us, because we've always did with more conservative elements. Now, of course, it's gone full circle, because now we have the Tea Party and members of the House who call Ted Cruz and ask for advice. And it's a completely different environment. When Tom Craddock became the Speaker, it became so partisan. George Bush used to, when he was running for president, talk about how the Texas legislature is bipartisan, and it was to a large degree. but it was controlled by conservative elements, whether Democratic or Republican. But when Tom Craddock became the speaker, it became horrible. It was so partisan, and it changed. It was a game changer when Tom Craddock came in, of course, with the help of Tom DeLay. And it's getting better now. We overthrew the bad guy speaker, and we have a moderate Republican who's now the speaker. Of course.
Would this be a good time to do a real quick rundown of the Ardmore Killer D escape and return?
I'd be glad to. 2003 was when the Republicans took complete control of the Texas legislature. Every statewide elected official was a Democrat, and that's true today. I mean, a Republican, and that's true today, Republicans. Tom Craddock was the first Republican speaker elected since Reconstruction, and a guy named Tom DeLay, who was at that time the House Majority Leader, he had helped Tom Craddock become the speaker, and he had helped the Republicans take complete control. He had poured a lot of money into races. Unfortunately, it was corporate money, and that wasn't allowed back then. He ultimately, Tom DeLay, got convicted of money laundering and misappropriation of federal resources. But he came down and wanted to redraw the congressional boundaries. We had done redistricting a few years earlier, like every other state in the nation. You do it after the census is taken. But Tom DeLay came down and said to the speaker, I want to increase my majority in the United States Congress. I want to pick up 7 more Republican seats. We can do that by redrawing the lines to guarantee that Democratic incumbents cannot win. And that was why all of a sudden Tom DeLay was walking around the House chamber. There were about a week and a half left in the session, and the redistricting committee was meeting. It shouldn't have been meeting. We did that 3 years earlier. And then we figured out what was going on. And so the Democrats, a few of us met and said, we have to stop it. It's a pure partisan power grab. No state had ever revisited redistricting during the middle of the decade unless a court had ordered it to do so. But here we knew that there was about a little over a week left in the session, and this congressional redistricting bill was being shoved down our throats. And so we said, what can we do? We don't have the votes to stop it. And one person said, if we shut down government, if we leave, then they can't meet if they don't have a quorum, and maybe we could stop it that way. But we would have to be gone for 5 or 6 days until a certain deadline would kick in, after which no bills, including Tom DeLay's redistricting bill, could be voted out. And that's what we did. We decided to go to Ardmore, Oklahoma, to leave the state. We knew if we stayed in the state and broke a quorum, the Texas Rangers and the state troopers would come after us. But if we left the state, that's why we went to Ardmore and not Santa Fe or New Orleans, because at that time the governor and lieutenant and attorney general of Oklahoma were Democrats, and they told our lawyers, if your crazy 51 Democratic House members can somehow make it across the Red River into Oklahoma without getting busted by the Texas Rangers, yeah, they can stay in Oklahoma. We won't let the Rangers execute.
So 51 Democrats simply disappeared.
Piled onto buses, 2 charter buses in the middle of the night. It was Mother's Day. That Monday, they were supposed to take up the congressional redistricting bill, and we were gone. So that morning, that Monday morning, and we were watching on laptops. We couldn't hear it. You could see the speaker gavel the House to order, and then they do a quorum count, and the parliamentarians leaned over to the speaker and said, Mr. Speaker, you cannot conduct business. There's no quorum. And he said, what are you talking about? There's no quorum. We have letters from 51 members. They took their keys. You don't have a quorum. Tom DeLay went through the roof, but they couldn't conduct business. But we had a week, and we had
this was unprecedented, wasn't it?
This had never happened anywhere in the country.
Right.
Members shut down the legislature and left the state for good reason. We were doing our job. We were representing our constituencies. We were protecting incumbent Democratic members of Congress, including Chet Edwards, including Lloyd Doggett. We were doing our jobs. We had anticipated everything we thought, but we never anticipated that Tom DeLay, the House Majority Leader, would be so enraged, so incensed, that he would dispatch agents of the Department of Homeland Security to track us down. And think about that for a second. Homeland Security, created to protect you and your loved ones against terrorists. We were duly elected legislators. We happened to be Democrats. We broke no rules. We broke no laws. We broke a quorum. And they sent Homeland Security to track us down. By the way, the rules say that if a quorum is broken, the speaker can use, quote, any means necessary to bring us back. So in the end, there were 51 of us, quote, hiding out at the Holiday Inn in Ardmore, Oklahoma, eating at the Denny's. And the Texas Rangers never found us. The state troopers never found us. Homeland Security never found us. It took a cub reporter, like an intern with the Dallas Morning News, whose supervisor said, they're not in Texas. If they were in Texas, the Rangers would have found them. So he pulled out a map. Ardmore, that's the closest city that could accommodate 51, and they sent this kid up there, and there we were the next morning. It was front page news in almost every paper in the country. The Austin American Statesman read, a front page, AWOL Democrats found in Oklahoma, and the whole front page was mugshots of the 51 of us.
I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. We're talking with Elliot Neistat. We'll be right back.
Old friends sat on their park bench like bookends, a newspaper blown through the grass falls on the round toes of the high shoes of the old friends. Old friends, winter companions, the old men lost in their overcoats waiting for the sunset. The sounds of the city sifting through trees settle like dust on the shoulders of the old friends. Can you imagine us years from today sharing a park bench quietly? How terribly strange to be 70. Old friends, memory brushes the same, silently sharing the same fear.
Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. My guest is Elliot Neistat, who is leaving the Texas legislature after 26 years, and he will be sorely missed. Elliot has been telling us some wonderful stories. We just talked about the case of the missing. It's like a detective story. The case of the missing Democrats.
It is, but I just have to finish it. We actually killed the bill. We were the heroes. 4,000 people greeted us when we came back. And I wish the story ended there, but Governor Perry called three back-to-back special sessions. The senators went to New Mexico, but one of them said, "Ya basta, enough." And so in the end, Tom DeLay got most of what he wanted, not all of it, until the U.S. Supreme Court overturned parts. But as you all know, Tom DeLay is no longer House Majority Leader, is no longer a member of Congress, and his on appeal, some of the charges have been overturned.
It was determined that checks were not money.
Checks are not money, and
we need to. We've got 15 minutes left, and that's not enough time for us to talk about your legacy. That could be another entire show. There's a few things that you had wanted to talk about in terms of bills that you either passed or that didn't pass. And so I'm going to let you had sent me a list of these, and a lot of them have stories behind them. And so I'm going to let you choose the ones that you think are most interesting for us for our last segment here.
Show me the list.
Okay. Show me the list.
Yeah, these all have stories associated with them. One of them is landlord-tenant security devices bills. And when I was in my second term, a woman came to me with an amazing story about how she moved down from Chicago and she was moved into an apartment complex and she was afraid. And she went to her landlord and said, "Can I have a keyless deadbolt lock put on my door?" And the apartment manager said, no keyless deadbolt lock. You have the regular bolted lock, and that's all we'll do. And because if there's an emergency, we can't get in there. And so she, needless to say, was attacked and raped about 3 months later and came to me and said, "If I'd had a keyless deadbolt, if apartments were required to have them, this wouldn't have happened." And I agreed and introduced a bill that would require every apartment, every rental unit, to have, in addition to the regular lock, a keyless deadbolt and a door viewer. It took two sessions to get it passed. She had to come back the second session and tell her story. That was an important bill, anti-rape bill. Indoor air quality. When I worked for Senator Barrientos, a bunch of parents from Wimberley came and said that a brand new elementary school opened up and all the kids were sick, all of them, and they had gone to the principal and the superintendent, and they said, "It's just a coincidence that all those kids are sick." And so Senator Barrientos sent the Department of Health down there, and they came back and said, "Unusually high levels of formaldehyde." And the senator said, "Okay, well, get down there and do something." And they said, "We have no authority to do anything." So when I got elected a couple of years later, I introduced the Texas Indoor Air Quality Act, which would have given the state the tools it need to establish indoor air quality standards and enforce them. Of course, the private sector, the business community, killed that bill. We don't want the state coming into our Walmart or our Starbucks. And that took me two sessions, and in the end, what I got was a bill concerning indoor air quality in public schools with voluntary compliance. Not much, but it's a story. Nursing home regulatory reform. That was one of the most important bills that I passed. There were newspaper stories all about people dying in nursing homes, and the nursing home regulatory legislation statute was so weak, and I worked with AARP to reform the regulatory processes, and it was a very tough, strong bill. had a 21-prong Bill of Rights for nursing home residents, and we tripled the penalties, and it was good, but when the day before I was supposed to debate it in the House, a bunch of members came to me and said, "Elliot, I know we need to do something, but your bill goes too far, and all the mom-and-pop nursing homes will have to shut down." And I said, "What are you talking about? If you have good nursing homes, it's only the bad actors that'll probably have some problem." And they said, no, we can't support your bill." "Who's telling you that?" "Well, the nursing home lobbyists." And so I convened a meeting with AARP, which has over 2 million members in Texas, and said, "You've got 1 week. I'm going to postpone the bill. You get your members to go visit members of the legislature back home and here. You have 1 week, and get your members, your legislators, to understand how important this is." And they did that. They spent a week lobbying real hard, AARP. And it was a week later. That morning, the bill was scheduled to be heard. And all these members who had come to me earlier and said, "We can't support it because the nursing home lobbyists say you'll have to shut down all the mom and pops," they all came back to me and said, "You know, I've been thinking about that nursing home bill that you have, and that is important, and people have been dying, and I'm signing on, and so are these 15, and then 10 others. I'm signing on, Elliot." And I said, "Well, good, you're doing the right thing." And in turn, each group said, "Now, would you please call off AARP? Medical marijuana. I introduced that 6 sessions.
Now we're getting into stuff that actually didn't pass here.
Well, with medical marijuana, you have to look at legislation as a process,
right?
And that incremental change is really important. So I was not able to even get a hearing on my bill. And my bill was very conservative. It didn't legalize anything. It created an affirmative defense. So if you have a bona fide medical condition, AIDS, cancer, multiple sclerosis, others, you have a bona fide medical condition and your doctor suggests that you try it because it's worked in other states. By the way, 23 states have legalized medicinal marijuana. So if you have a bona fide medical condition, and if your doctor suggests you try it, and if you're doing that in your house and you get busted, then you can go before a judge. That's the affirmative defense. You can say, "Your Honor, I'm sick. Look at me. I'm not a criminal. I have multiple sclerosis. My doctor suggested it. It helps me live. It helps me work." The judge would have the discretion, could dismiss the charges, wouldn't have to. And I could not get that bill to even get a vote in committee. And this year, we passed a bill which they claim is medicinal marijuana, but it's really low THC. It's called cannabidiol, and it helps kids who are experiencing serious seizures and they have intractable epilepsy. So we did pass it. You have to take it orally. You can't smoke it. You can't get high on it. But this is happening in several states, and it will help the kids with intractable epilepsy, but it won't help anybody else. But it's a step in the right direction, because now at least the people in Texas can say, well, marijuana is medicinal because they passed that bill to help kids with epilepsy. Domestic partner benefits.
Okay, before, just incidentally, your position on non-medical marijuana is?
Well, I think that every state should either authorize the use of medicinal marijuana through an affirmative defense or lowering the penalties, or legalize it. And as far as for recreational use, sure, I think it would be fine, but I can understand members of the legislature, not just in Texas. What they always told me was, "Elliot, sure, medicinal marijuana says great, but I can't afford to look weak on crime. My uncle is a deputy sheriff. I cannot afford to be a member of the Texas House and look soft on crime."
Of course, if it were legalized, then it wouldn't be a crime. But exactly, then that's,
exactly.
That's too logical, probably.
Domestic partner benefits. My legislation, I introduced it about five times, would authorize the University of Texas system and the Texas A&M system to offer domestic partner benefits, which are not authorized or not legal at universities, public universities. And this became so difficult. As your listeners know, domestic partner benefits are authorized, are legal at, I think, about 500 universities, public and private, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, all over the country. Many of the privates in Texas offer it. But I just couldn't get it going at all. I couldn't get a hearing at first, and then they felt it went too far, too fast. This year, we introduced it again, and it became law, but not because of my legislation, because the United States Supreme Court authorized or okayed gay marriage. So sometimes your legislation, you can be visionary, and it happens because somebody intervenes. In this case, it was the U.S. Supreme Court. Medicaid expansion. This has been my biggest disappointment. The Affordable Care Act and Medicaid expansion, the U.S. Supreme Court, when it approved, when it upheld the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, it said that in one case you went too far, and that is in requiring states, mandating that states expand Medicaid. That has to be optional. And so I think there are still about 18 states that have not expanded Medicaid. Governor Perry stood tall and adamantly said that Texas will not do anything that has to do with President Obama and Medicaid expansion and Affordable Care Act. And so it hasn't happened. And this started two sessions ago, and I remember speaking out and saying, Governor Perry is refusing to allow Texas to participate in the expansion of Medicaid. This is short-sighted. This is mean-spirited. This is fiscally irresponsible. What Perry is doing is rejecting $90 billion in federal Affordable Care Act money over a 10-year period and foregoing the opportunity to provide health coverage to 1.5 million low-income and working Texans. I think most of your listeners know that Texas has the highest rate, the highest percentage of uninsured people in the nation, and we recently passed California, which does participate in Medicaid expansion. So now Texas has the highest percentage and the highest number of uninsured people in the state. Once again, we could not get leadership, including the governor and in particular the lieutenant governor, to even consider expanding Medicaid in a way that would be a Texas solution, as many other states headed up by Republicans have done. And so now we're working closely with great organizations like Families USA. But what I found interesting was that I had a bill that would simply help kids who get in trouble and who are on Medicaid. These are kids who break the law, and they end up in the juvenile detention facilities. They're convicted, and when they go in, they automatically lose their children's health insurance coverage or their Medicaid coverage. And when they've done their time and they get out, they have to reapply, and that can take a month. So I came up with a plan, working with some of the health advocates, to create what's called presumptive eligibility. So these kids, when they finish their time and are released, will be presumptively eligible for Medicaid, and they won't lose coverage for a month or so. Okay. And that bill was killed on third reading because everyone thought Medicaid presumptive eligibility, he's trying to do an end run around Medicaid expansion.
How presumptuous.
So we had to change the name, and even though they'd killed it, I worked with some Republican leaders, and we got the bill pass. But Medicaid has created problems for the legislature in terms of doing what we should be doing, which is expanding it in accordance with the Affordable Care Act.
Okay, Elliot Neistat, we have 1 minute. I want some final sort of perspective from you. When you look back on it, and when you look forward, how do things look to you?
I think it's very important when you're a progressive or a liberal to understand that you speak a language which is unheard of, which is incomprehensible to many members of the legislature, and that people work hard and spend lots of money to get elected, and they're afraid. They're afraid that if they don't comply with what Grover Norquist and the leadership says, which is we need to starve the beast, we need to reduce government. It's not the role of government to do what FDR did or LBJ did. And if you don't play the game with us, we'll get a opponent to challenge you in the primary and you'll lose. So Republicans are really afraid. They're really afraid to do the right thing. And you have to understand that when you sit down and try to convince them that this is in the best interest of your constituents and the people of Texas.
Okay, we got to go. Elliot Neistat, thank you for being with us on Rag Radio. We've already committed to doing it again soon. I'm Thorne Dreyer, Rag Radio.